Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bound, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On the show today, we'll be heading to Latin America via some of the region's most agenda-setting images and photographers from the past few decades, with curators Maria Wills and Alexis Fabri.
We'll also be hearing from sporting legend. Surfer Laird Hamilton will be discussing life lessons learned while riding some of the world's biggest waves.
And we'll be visiting London's Coronet Theatre, where pioneering Scottish artist Bruce MacLean is unveiling his latest project.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Marcus Hippie will be joining us to look ahead to next week's news, and there'll be some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Fernando, I, like you, am a sun worshipper. I haven't seen the Pacheco legs out this week. It's been a disgusting week in England.
Disgusting.
How can we make amends?
I don't
understand. In a radio way.
You know what, Rob? I bought a pair of shorts and I didn't wear them yet because there's no weather for that.
There is no weather for that.
But you know what's the solution for a week like that? To absorb yourself in the world of pop music.
Okay. And this is what you've been doing?
Of course.
Okay.
I went to see the Spice Girls. I bought Madonna's latest album. I've seen Big Little Lies. You know what I mean?
Wow.
That's the week where I could do that because, you know, it was so miserable that that made me happy.
That's an amazing thing. Tell us about the Spice Girls then. I knew you'd been to see them, but for our listeners, you clearly danced. Did you cry?
I didn't cry. It was close when they sang goodbye, you know.
Yeah.
But some of the fans, they did cry. I did have a. Were you a fan at the time?
I wasn't a fan, but I mean, they were kind of the music I was into then. It was the opposite of. They were the pop irritant that you couldn't help loving. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. That was kind of what they were. But now times have changed. You mellow in your 40s. and of course, I mean, I think that's amazing.
That was certainly
as a live show, I would love to see them. Yeah.
Oh, there's still time. Oh, no, I think today, actually, they're performing the last one in London.
Oh, dear. Well, that's the time to shed a tear.
Exactly.
Have you got any other top tips for making yourself feel sunny when it's raining outside?
Well, I think we should listen to Marcus Hippie's News Look Ahead, right?
Yeah, is that the way to do it?
I think so.
When in doubt, turn to Finland for your sunshine. Here he comes, toddling around the corner. It's Marcus Hippie. Marcus, welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon. How are you guys doing?
Well, pretty well, I think.
Do you have some pop static news for us, Marcus?
I'm afraid not. It's a bit of a gloomy day here in London. But there is some more exciting stuff actually happening in Finland in the coming week. There is, if you love technology, if you're a bit of a geek, you may enjoy Helsinki this coming week.
Why?
You're looking at me like I'm the man that doesn't know how to switch his computer on.
Well, you look like a guy who may enjoy a driverless robo bus in that case.
I'll try and take that as a compliment.
Between a shopping centre and a nearby junction.
Okay.
Because that's what's happening in Finland, in Helsinki this coming week. So there is the Helsinki Robo Bus Line, which is a project by the local university. Well, they're taking now passengers on a 5-minute journey in the Kalasatama district of Helsinki. So obviously this bus won't have a driver, but it will use, you may be excited by this word, it's using LiDAR, which is a laser-based version of radar.
Okay, I love that, LiDAR.
I'm quite surprised. So they will have actual people, you know, in a driverless bus.
Because that has to happen eventually if they're going to make these buses viable, I thought. So they're testing
oh,
that
man.
Now. And I don't know, would you? It's not a very exciting journey, I can reveal you. It's between a shopping centre and between a bridge that's a 5-minute journey away.
Sounds like quite a potentially perilous route for the maiden voyage of a driverless bus.
I think they're trying to avoid too much traffic, but I think it's a nice thing. If I was bored in Helsinki, sometimes, you know, you are there and you're like, don't really know what to do. You may want to try this bus. Anyway, I get to brag with my Finnish pronunciation, so if anyone's curious, this bus goes between Englantilais Aukio Square and Iso Isän Silta.
Easy.
Well, let's move on. Let's return to London now. Let's continue to Regent's Park. Taste of London food event starts on Wednesday, the 19th.
Especially for you, right?
That should be good. So really interesting names cooking there this year. We have Jota Mottolenghi, Tom Akins, Melissa Hemsley, Francesca Mazze and Sabrina Geyer there cooking. And also there was this one very interesting chef I just interviewed for the latest edition of the menu, Cobus van der Merwe from South Africa, whose restaurant was recently ranked to be the best in the world, according to one publication, not Monocle though. But it's kind of an interesting concept. It's about, if I remember correctly, about 200 kilometers away from Cape Town on the coast. And it's meant to be a very nice place. But anyway, I interviewed this chef, Cobus, for the menu. So if you want to find out more, just listen to the show. I have one more news story for you.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's not all over. On Friday, bring your dog to work day. I don't know who comes up with these days. Recently, I've been getting emails being like, how are you noticing? How are you noting the world gin and tonic martini day? I'm like, who comes up with this? Who comes up with this? Who decided that Friday the 21st is going to bring your dog to work day? I think that's all for the coming week.
Thank you very much indeed, Marcus Hippie. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be talking photography with Maria Wills and Alexis Fabry. Don't go away. London's Photographers Gallery is currently showcasing some of the most striking images to emerge from across Latin America over the past 50 years.
The show Urban Impulses collects the work of over 70 photographers working between 1959 and 2016. It includes talents such as Alberto Corda, whose images capture the story of the Cuban Revolution, and Graciela Iturbide, whose photography has depicted subjects ranging from Mexico's indigenous communities to LA street gangs.
The exhibition's curators, Maria Wills and Alexis Fabry, join us now to discuss it. Welcome both of you to the Monocle Weekly. And congratulations, I was also say, on a wonderful show. It's tough to pot 50 years of wonderful photography. What was your starting point on it? Because there is also the photography of record, there's also great beauty in it. What were some of the things that you definitely wanted to get in there?
For Alexis and I, it's been a challenge. He's been working in Latin America for the past 20 years, so he is French, but in a way Latin American. I'm from Colombia. And yes, we know it's crazy to make this huge temporary frame into a show, but we do believe during this period many things happened and there's a common thread that can be done through Latin America, even if one could question why bringing or putting all Latin America together, this question of Latin America, ser Latinoamericano, being a Latin American, even though there's like specificities to every single country, and we do not want to make generalizations. But we do see during this period upheavals. I mean, we do start in 59. We chose that because we do want to bring out the political side, the political fights that were going on. And I mean, the Cuban Revolution is the year we begin at. And throughout the show, which is divided in two chapters, Shouts and Popular, we want to show a side B or another perspective of Latin America that goes beyond cliches and exoticisms and more towards the changes in the cities, in urban life. So Urban Impulse implies many different things that I think we will tell you about more, but I want to let Alexis also speak.
Hi, Alexis.
Hello.
Welcome. Were there certain things that you, certain touchstones, either photographers or images, or both, that you kind of had to get in there, that you knew were part of the canon of great Latin American photography?
The exhibition is divided into two different chapters, and one of the two is Popular. One is more political, it's titled Shouts, and the other one is Popular. And perhaps one of the things that really is present in a lot of countries in photography in Latin America is the fact that there's a strong relation between high fine art and popular culture. Mm-hmm. And I think that was one of the main things we wanted to focus on. And also I think if in the two chapters indifferently, you have a lot of experimentation. I think it's a continent that was very creative in terms of experimentation. And the definition of photography in the show is not very strict, not very orthodox. We have Xerox, we have collage with
silkscreen and graphic art. Yeah.
And that's what I enjoyed about the exhibition, because even when it comes to the political photography, there's also kind of even a funny kind of
cheeky side. I love the one where they're holding a poster, you know, saying Nixon, hijo de la puta, you know. So I quite enjoy that as well. So it's not just the cliche, like people battling in the streets.
I believe that there's something in common between our countries. As I was saying before, we've done quite a few shows together. And this time I found that, I mean, Latin America can have this great sense of, I wouldn't say, well, positivity, but humor also, cynicism in a way also regarding our situations, the crises we go through. And we deal them in a similar way. There's always like this humor behind it. And also regarding popular culture, for example, one of the chapters, which is Shouts, that calls for fights that people had to go through, social and even gender issues. Shouts relies also to this question of crisis, tension, fire, shouts, you know, on the political side. But then these people that could be on strikes can easily go to a bar and just enjoy their night with shouts of joy.
In Mexico, they have something they call Fiesta de los Muertos, Fiesta de Muertos, and that's characteristic of the continent, that you can even enjoy death.
Totally. Or even in Colombia, where I'm from, there were moments of like peace in which guerrillas and paramilitary would just say no to arms. This is a moment of like enjoyment. And that's something really powerful that lies also. I mean, you can sort of feel it in the exhibition. So what I was saying is you can feel the body, because we see the body, we see nakedness, we see sexuality a lot also. So the body as a territory for violence in these like very strong like social movements and upheavals, and then the body as a territory for pleasure, sexuality, which is really, you can see it in the exhibition.
Yeah, there's
and
a lot
the
of...
medium also is a territory of conflict. The medium, adding painting to a photograph, scratching it, it's also...
Yes, it's very... When we thought about pulsions, because it's our urban impulses, so pulsion, the pulsion, even from a psychoanalytical point of view, has to do with the body. And we thought of it also, one of the important parts of the show has to do with this medium extending itself, photography. Also, photographers did not have studies in many of them. Of course, there's many of these photographers. Another nice thing about the show is that they're like really known photographers that have gone into the photographical canon, and some other ones that are really discoveries that Alexis, well, in my case in Colombia, we've done together, and that were completely in the marginal side of art, also because they were working in very different mediums, also because of scarcity. I mean, they had conditions where they could not find the paper, or maybe, I mean, so, and they also want, and politically, they also wanted to make works that could be easy, that could circulate easily. So that's another way of the pulsion, of the pulse.
There are a lot of murals, there are a lot of walls, and there's a lot of the idea of the unfinished. You know, there's political graffiti that then an official has sort of painted over, but badly, gloriously badly, for some of the pictures in your collection, in your exhibition. This notion of the unfinished, and then as you say, doctoring the images, painting in the colours or highlighting some of the colours. Is that a Latin American thing? Is that an idea of everything, an idea maybe copying some of the politics, that everything is in flux, that the art itself is in flux, the reportage is in flux, Alexis?
You'll be more precise, but one main influence in Latin America, in a lot of countries in those years, in the 60s, 70s, was the Spanish informalist. Mm-hmm. So I think Tapies mainly was exhibited very early there. And I think a lot of artists that used the walls, as you described, they used it also with an informalist intention. So there was also, you were also, at the beginning, you were just questioning the notion of beauty. And I think that's where it is also.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that this question of influences is very, very difficult, because we have 70 artists and one never knows who saw what. I mean, when we talk to them, we obviously know, but obviously the informalism is there. And also the fact, and something that we've grown doing together, is that we've become really interested in also photographs that don't come out of photographers, but maybe of painters that did those photographs as a sketch for something.
As a study or something.
And the notion of the sketch for us is as important as the finished piece, which is a little like something that we've done together also through the works, for example, through discovering works like, for example, Fernel Franco, who's a Colombian photographer, who would paint over his photographs. So So what I do think is really particular to Latin America is that we do see these sacrilegious, I don't know if that's the right word, but sacrilegio, because since they didn't have like a formal education that would forbid, say, this is possible and this is not possible, they just have no boundaries. And that makes it really, really interesting.
It makes it very vivid as well. I mean, your show, I mean, the work itself and the way you've put it together, it's very visceral stuff.
Very much so. And I think, Maria, you touched on the topic of, sexuality and gender. And it's interesting because a lot of people see Latin America as quite a conservative continent. But at the same time, it's quite open as well. I mean, there's this wonderful picture about a Chilean photographer, right? There's a transvestite smoking but wearing like a beautiful clothing, it's black and white. I think this is one of the most magical images that actually stayed in my mind. If you can tell me a bit more about this as well.
I think in the show, I think during the 70s mainly, until the 70s, there was a generation of photographers that really believed that when they had to work on violence, when they have to denounce violence, they had to show the violence very realistically. Pace Rasulis, the Chilean photographer you mentioned, she took a bold side, and it was a way for her to describe a community of transvestites in the Santiago during the Pinochet regime that was under surveillance, permanent surveillance from the Pinochet authorities. I think it was a kind of protest for her to exalt the beauty of those people, but it had a political meaning, and in that case, that community was totally marginalized. In Chile, in the 80s, you have a generation of photographers who became photographers only to protest. They were not prepared to be photographers. They just took the camera to document the terror. So in a sense, it's a strange situation where you have an entire generation of photographers who became photographers almost for historical reasons. Not.
And on the other hand, I would like to add to that because now we're in a globalized world and nobody wants to be labeled as a Latin American or American, and I believe in that too. But in this period where we start from, the artists were making colloquiums and gatherings in order to build a strong Latin American identity, in order to go against influences from the North. I mean, imperialist, there was this strong. So that's also important to see that it starts in the Cuban Revolution, because, I mean, through that train of thought is what they have in mind. So, and also, which I would like to point out, the popular, because we have a chapter about popular art. But like the pop, is that also? Is it being a popular that is not transparently received or translated? I mean, it's more a pop that is done through the vernacular, through local references. That obviously has to have to do with consumption, but it's a whole different thing that I really hope that people can see when they see the show.
And it's interesting you're saying about the influence, because, I mean, if you look, I mean, I know it's not about photography, but if you look at music these days, I mean, Latin America is extremely influential. So actually, it's becoming the opposite.
Yes.
They are sending their product to the North in a way, in a funny kind of way.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And the margins are now the center.
Mm-hmm.
Or I don't know if we want to be the center, but I mean, we there's surely something going on.
And Spanish-speaking literature, beginning in the 60s, the boom. Mm-hmm. The boom was Spanish-speaking literature was mainly Latin American.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. More than Spanish.
Yes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it was. It was Borges and everything coming back.
Yeah.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about a lot of the homemade nature of this, and I don't mean the collage and the painting on the photographs and things, but actually some of the street art, as in terms of these rather beautiful paintings on the side of buildings for strip joints and things. And you know, it's kind of like homemade advertising. And there's I guess Superman, the movie, must have just come out, and there's a kind of home painted sign that maybe the cinema photographer put over his own cinema and things like that. And then next to it is a very plush Marlboro Man commercial, which was obviously done by Philip Morris in America. And there's something kind of, to my Western eyes, and I don't mean this in a bad way, something charming about that. Does it look the same? Does it look the same to both of you? I mean, Maria, especially you being from there, does it have the same charm? Or do you think, come on, It's this amazing. Is what it was, and it's not like that anymore.
No, well, I actually love vernacular popular art and the fact, and I do believe that that is something very particular to our continent. They had no, I mean, it was easier for a Colombian industry to be built on, it's not even an industry, on handcrafted things or art or popular artists that had no notion of like formal or academic painting. And it happens in all, and still happens in many, many stores, but it's in process how do you say, the extinction? It's in, which this show has that nostalgic side to it. I mean, traditional and handcrafted and traditions that are done in our continent are being lost through industrialization and massive processes. So for sure, this show has a. I don't know. What do you think?
I think, strangely, in the contemporary art scene in the West, I think that there's a comeback of the what is done by hand. I think Picasso, when he wanted to describe someone who was a bad painter, he said it's painted by hand. But but I think there's a return of the hand, because in a very cold technological society, the heart of the hand is needed. But so in a sense, even in the official West.
Yes, but that's the particular thing that I hope. Actually, right now I'm working in a project in Colombia that has to do with handcrafted and vernacular practices and even indigenous, because we're seeing that going into the mainstream. You even go to art fairs now, and that's what you see. So it's maybe that's the way it's going to happen, that through like mainstream artists looking into that, there's going to be a recovery, and the local popular, like the real creators of that, I hope they're going to be highlighted and not lose their practices.
It's fascinating stuff. Thank you both very much
thank you.
For coming in. Maria Wills and Alexis Fabry, the curators of Urban Impulse's Latin American Photography from 1959 to 2016, is on now at the Photographers Gallery in London. Until, well, for ages, Faye, until the 6th of October.
Plenty of time.
Plenty of time. Thank you. Time for a tune. We'll be hearing from surfing legend Laird Hamilton in just a moment. So here's an oldie but a goodie from California's The OCs. This is Tidal Wave.
Tidal Wave by the OCs there. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly on Monaco 24. We'll be hearing from Laird Hamilton just after this.
When it comes to surfing, Laird Hamilton is known as a pioneer. Among the many innovations the Hawaii and California-based big wave rider has helped push forward is tow-in surfing, using water vehicles such as jet skis to get enough speed up to catch truly gargantuan waves. It's allowed him to ride 30-foot monsters such as the one that became known as the Millennium Wave, a crushingly powerful wall of water he famously caught off the island of Tahiti back in 2000.
Now he's created a book, Life Rider. It distills a few of the lessons he's learned while out on the waves, while also pursuing ventures on dry land too, that have ranged from fitness programs to entrepreneurship.
Monocle's Tom Hall spoke to him earlier and began by asking him what an average day for Laird looks like.
Well, you know, the great thing is there's no average day, so I'd like to say it's always new and different. And I mean, my lifestyle is a little bit like the seasons of the year, you know, where there's periods of high output, but in general, you know, I sleep, I give sleep a big priority. I sleep 8 or 9 hours a night. I go to bed early. I wake up normally in the dark, and I let the day, I'm able, my lifestyle is fortunate enough that I can let the day dictate what I do. The conditions and the environment will dictate what I do, but you know, it's gonna, the day usually consists of a few different activities. I mean, listen, I'll do domestic stuff when I'm able to. I take my daughter to school and those things, but I will be in the heat. I will be in the ice during a day. You know, I will do some kind of breathing. I'll do some kind of sport. I'll do some handyman repair stuff around my house. For me, I think a productive day really consists of a multitude of activities, you know, and designating time to the different business affairs that I have and spending time with my wife and, you know, like just really trying to live full days, like full productive days. And you know, again, it depends on the time of year and what's going on with work when you have travel and you have other obligations. But I'm always trying to eat well and just be more focused on every aspect of living, of all those details in life that can bog us down. My wife and I both have a theory where we just change our perspective. Instead of saying, oh, I have to, we say we get to. So we get to do the things that we do. We get to live how we live. And I think that perspective really changes the dynamic of each day.
I mean, I wanted to sort of go back to how sort of surfing has informed your life's sort of perspective. Have there been any real lessons specifically while you're on a board that have suddenly been like light bulb moments where you're like, oh, that's something that I can apply across everything, not just out here on the waves?
I mean, listen, the ocean has influenced a lot of my behavior, and there's, you know, and nothing like the possibility of drowning and not coming home to really make you appreciative and to bring a sense of priority when it comes to how you live and what you live. First of all, the patience that the ocean teaches you, the reverence, the respect, the lessons that come from the sea are longer than the pages of all the books put together. So the master teacher is the ocean, and surfing is the sport that we do in our relationship with the ocean. It's the activity that we do to have the relationship with the ocean. And a sailor knows it, and a diver knows it, and people have all these different forms of relationships. And ultimately, it's about a relationship with nature, you know, and the fact is that we get to do our harmonious act with the nature that makes us part of it.
One element that I was really interested in your book, I've heard you say in the past that a lot of people will ask you a question like, oh, describe that moment of when you're just about to drop in on the biggest wave. And I think your answer has in the past been something akin to, it's such a singular experience that it's almost not worth explaining because it's like so few people sort of get to do it. But one thing that really struck me in the book was where you talk about when things go wrong on a wave and you wipe out and you're under the waves, and that's when you need your body to be efficient, when you need to be able to preserve that stillness so that you don't waste energy because you can literally use up all your oxygen in seconds. Are there examples of those moments where things have gone pretty drastically wrong where you've managed to use some of these lessons that you've taught yourself in really effective ways?
You know, I always talk about life being a formulaic process. And the fact is that the formulas that you have during failure or mistakes or in critical moments is implementable to any similar situations, whether it's in the ocean or not. So the fact is that the thing that helps you survive a horrendous wipeout on a giant wave will probably be similar to a failure in business or something in a relationship. You go through a similar process, slowing everything down, not overreacting, and you learn certain techniques in these moments that are implementable to your entire life that you've used in your life, whether you're involved in some natural disaster, a hurricane, a fire, a flood. When you go into these situations of danger, and I'm talking about physical, but it could be emotional even. I mean, you can implement the same formula that you use in some sort of physical danger into some emotional danger. The old measure twice, cut once. I mean, using those kind of metaphors, it only has been helpful.
Measure twice, cut once. That's a good lesson for everyone, I think. In the book, I don't want to make it too basic, but you, from what I read from it, I kind of got the impression that you're trying to instill in people that they should kind of trust their intuition and that a healthy body creates a healthy mind. I mean, you've been surfing all of your life and you've been athletic all of your life. At what age did you sort of really start to crystallize those thoughts and say to yourself, oh, this is actually a lifestyle and almost a theory rather than just something I get up and do every day?
You know, I think it's been a long process. You know, it's kind of like the hardening of a substance. I think it takes a lot of time. I mean, a diamond, you know, I don't know how long, but it takes a lot of compression and a lot of time to make a diamond. At the end of the day, these things, they've come over a long period of time and they've been hardening. And I think ultimately the crystallization of all of these thoughts and beliefs, it will continue until I'm no longer here. At least I would hope. I mean, that would be the optimum situation. But I think it usually comes a little later on in life, just because part of it is when you start to have to explain yourself. I think the beginning for me comes with children. I have one daughter that's 23 already. And, you know, when your first child comes, for those of us who have children, it seems like that's the beginning of where you start maybe losing some of your complete selfishness, and you start to consider things outside of yourself, and then you have to start to consider how you're going to explain yourself to them.
Yeah.
You know? And what's that going to look like, and what kind of parent are you going to be? And that definitely. And then I think also the vulnerability of death, the presence of the possibility of death. Well, it's always present, but when it's more obvious in a heightened moment, you know, when you get exposed to maybe not being here anymore, you know, every time that happens to you, I think you start to begin to solidify some very strong opinions.
I wanted to sort of get onto that topic. I know that death is an incredibly sort of bleak blanket thing to be talking about, but you do talk about it in the book, and you talk about that you felt that you were kind of around it quite a lot as a kid, because that's sort of the way of the sea, that you would lose friends and things like that. And you also talk about a friend of yours that moved into your house who was diagnosed, I think, with cancer and had months to live and started surfing every day and lived another 8 years. I mean, do you think that an awareness of death is actually a really healthy thing for humans to be engaged with, rather than just sort of trying to put it out of their mind all the time?
I think it's beautiful. I think it's mandatory. I think that our perspective on death changes everything. Your perspective of the end of our life as we know it will definitely influence the life we live when we're living. It's so ever present. It's as obviously as transformative as birth. So the two things are, you know, you're born and then you live and then you die. And so it seems like we should, if we're pretending like we're not, and I can say I was probably as much a part of that philosophy when I was young as all young people, but, you know, you feel invincible. And the fact that death was ever present definitely influenced my behavior. And then what happens? I mean, okay, being realistic about the presence of death and, first of all, the ease of dying. You know, I always say dying's easy, living's hard. Check it out. I mean, dying takes a second and living can take up to, you know, 80, 90, 100 years if you're unlucky.
It takes a lifetime if you're lucky, I guess. I'm interested in sort of how you sort of frame some of the ideas in the book over your career, because a lot of people don't have careers which are perhaps as visually and immediately sort of translative as impressive as yours. You know, if you work every day 9 to 5 in an office, you have to try and find the achievements within that. But I mean, have there been any specific achievements in your career which you're most proud of? Perhaps obviously the Millennium Wave back in 2000, where people were like, that's the heaviest wave ever surfed. Are there moments which you can sort of put your finger on where you're like, I did that, that's a real peak?
Well, I mean, the fact is that right now is the peak. Today is pretty the top of the list because I'm still here. So if living's the hard part, then today makes the being present at this moment makes that the pinnacle of achievement. But absolutely, waves like the Millennium Wave, things like stand-up paddling and foil surfing and tow-in surfing. I mean, these are in my career, these are benchmarks of for me. And, you know, when it comes to, first of all, I think the highest level of achievement that I feel like I could reach is the fulfillment of belief, right? The fulfillment of a belief or an idea. And I mean, the Millennium Wave was fulfillment of a belief that I believed that there was a wave that existed that was unrideable and that I could ride it. And trying to do that, I created a technique to be able to do that. So that was a very high in my belief achievement. And so is the belief that stand-up paddling could be what it is. I mean, they're paddling in Dubai, and, you know, and I started doing it on the Garden Island of Kauai. So, and foil surfing is exploding right now. And I mean, these are all monumental. These are ideas, not so per se like actually I went and did stuff. But, you know, I've done a bunch of endurance things. So I think it's ongoing. You know, we have I have a saying, and it's an anonymous stuntman said it, you know, never let your memories be bigger than your dreams. And so I have these things, and these are steps on the ladder, but they're just one of the steps. And I have other steps ahead, and I've got quite a few behind, but I'm still looking forward to the continuation.
And for absolute surfing noobs, as I'm sure many listeners might be, can you just tell us briefly why a wave like, say, the Millennium Wave was such a huge thing? What made it so difficult to surf?
Well, because it was that particular place, that type of wave, first of all, without the technique of being towed in, what is impossible to physically catch with our existing technique in surfing. So that was the undoable. That was the unrideable. Now, I always describe it like the 4-minute mile. Before the 4-minute mile was broken, no one could break 4 minutes. But once the guy broke 4 minutes, the next year, 27 people broke 4 minutes. And so it's a little bit like that. It was a barrier that existed. It was a barrier of belief, but it was also a physical barrier that existed, that we were incapable of being able to ride a wave with that velocity, and then we did. And so that kind of changed our perspective about what was rideable. That's what it represented. For me personally, it represented a lifelong belief that I could, you know, ride a wave that was unrideable, because there are waves unrideable, and there will always be waves that are unrideable. It's just, what is the definition, and can we change it?
In the book, you call the body almost like the ultimate machine. You're saying that people are always trying to improve technology and stuff, but they don't understand that they've got this like absolutely incredible piece of equipment at their disposal. But it just had a thought, just as you were talking there, about the waves that you surf and the towing in element, because I know that was like a little bit controversial at the time, because people were like, oh, it's not human to be towed in. What's your kind of perspective on people who critique that kind of surfing? I mean, do you see it as people who are scared of innovation, or do you think that people should be more open-minded? What's your thoughts on that?
Listen, I think that we put barriers up in our life that stop us from leaving the atmosphere. And I think at a certain point, if you want to go to the moon, you got to get on a rocket ship. It doesn't make it any less monumental because you got in a rocket and flew through the atmosphere. And so for me, I was like, I just felt like when we create definitions of things, we create walls that define us. One of the greatest aspects of being freer is not to be defined by a definition, is not to be defined. Like when you're a surfer and you're a wave rider and you're a pure wave rider in your heart, and you will do it when no one's watching, you'll do it because you love it. It's something that's in your soul. You don't discriminate with your equipment. When we grew up, we rode anything. We rode a door. We would ride a piece of wood. We'd ride a lunch tray. We boogie board. We body surf. We stand up paddle. We foil. We tow in. We do anything we can. We ride waves with canoes. We ride waves in boats. I mean, we're wave riders. And so don't limit yourself. I think we limit ourselves and the possibility of things by creating these definitions of what we think things are supposed to be. Like, oh, no, this is what you're doing, and you'd only do that, and that's the thing. And I go, if we did that, we would have never made a hammer.
Yeah. And finally, you've lived an extraordinary life, had an extraordinary career. If you were going to give one very, very simple lesson that everyone can put into their lives from this book, just their everyday going about their life way, what would you tell people to do to live a more productive life?
Well, I'll say what my mom told me once, which, if you can't be true to yourself, you can't be true to anyone else. Just be honest with yourself and be true to yourself. And I think you can be true to other people. I think it'll just help you. I know it's something that I implement and I try to live by every day, trying to live in truth, but be true to yourself. Be honest with yourself. And then you can really grow from there. Then we can expand, and that just opens up a whole world of possibilities.
Laird Hamilton there, speaking to Tom Hall, and Laird's book, Life Rider, Heart, Body, Soul, and Life Beyond the Ocean, is out now. You're listening to the Monaco Weekly.
Scottish artist Bruce MacLean's work has encompassed disciplines such as sculpture, performance art and painting over his 50-year career. And much of it's been underpinned by an anarchic wit that questions the role of art itself. In the 1960s, for example, the young MacLean first made his mark by rejecting academic norms about materials, creating sculptures out of discarded rubbish instead. His latest project is an animated film created with Gary Chitty that's part of an installation showing at London's Coronet Theatre. It's called The Decorative Potential of Blazing Factories. The film is a satirical piece highlighting the art world's disconnect from many of the realities of everyday life. Monocle's Augustin Macellari recently went to the Coronet Theatre to meet Bruce and the Coronet's artistic director, Anda Winter, to talk about the project.
Basically, it's about a very rich woman who wants to paint the most important painting of the 21st century. But in order to do so, she sets her father's factory alight. But she doesn't realise the consequences of her actions, and her father's house, which is next door, the fireplace which he has installed, a 750,000-tonne concrete cast-in-situ fireplace, is installed to house a fireside summit, unfortunately cracks with the heat of the fire. And so it goes on from there. A safety committee comes in to deal with it. The safety committee goes on fire. Table cracks, the whole thing cracks, and people start to stage things. It's all about superficiality, really, and detail, but the detail being nonsense, really. Mm. It's all a bit of a pose. The whole film is a bit of a pose, in a way, because it is all made of cardboard. That came, if you like, from me experiencing Bunraku Theatre in Japan, and I liked the fact that they did the whole thing with cardboard and puppets, and I hate puppets. I can't stand puppets en masse. In fact, I don't like the theatre very much, but I did think this thing was the best thing I think I've ever seen in the theatre in my life. Didn't turn the lights down, so you could see all the people moving, all the stuff, but instantly you were captivated by the action.
That idea, that engagement with the mechanics of, as you said, the pseudo-puppetry is a really enjoyable dimension to the film, I think.
Yeah.
How involved, Andrew, were you in the process of it being made, or was it a question for you of commissioning it? Have you been watching it as Bruce has continued?
Well, yes, it is a sort of a commission. It's co-production, I would almost say. Artistically, no, this is all credit goes to Bruce, to be honest.
Okay,
and Gary as well. But of course, I've been involved very much in the process. Mm. Not in the last 30 years, in the last, what would you say, year and a half, Bruce?
Yeah, the thing that's very good is that you said you support the thing and help us do the thing, and you have done that without going looking over my shoulder and stuff. It can't work like that, I think, and she is not like that. And that's it may be a great success, it may be a terrible disaster. Who knows?
It won't be as big a disaster as... I have seen it, yeah. I enjoyed it.
Did you?
Yeah, I did, yeah. I watched it yesterday.
That's one.
One down. I was going to say that, it's interesting that you've had it brewing for such a long time.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know that, and to me... Yesterday, watching it, it didn't strike me as a period piece, as you might say, as something that had been written in the late 80s. Is it the kind of timelessness of bureaucratic kind of jargon?
The thing is, everything seems to have got worse. I mean, I made a piece with Bill Furlong called Academic Board in 1974, and I'm an academic. Well, believe it or not, I was a professor. My mother didn't believe that, of course. It was getting worse and worse and worse. And all the things we suggested might be funny in 1974 became a reality in 2010 and so on. It was terrible. So the thing is, nothing changing. It just gets worse. So it's all there anyway. But if you come to the theatre, you will see drawings I made for the piece in 1986, 87. And it doesn't look much different from the drawings, actually, quite frankly.
How do you relate these disparate strands of your practice together, because you've had this very storied career across film, as mentioned, but also painting and performance. Where are the commonalities?
Well, the one basic thing that holds it all together is the fact that I'm a sculptor, and basically what I'm thinking about all the time is sculpture and what sculpture might be. I know that might sound a bit odd, but sculpture can be in a theatre, sculpture can be in a cinema, sculpture can be under the chair, sculpture can be on the chair, sculpture can be in your shirt. And I'm serious about the sculpture thing, and that's what holds it together. And I'm actually working on a book at the moment, which I think might help identify where it doesn't look. People just think, oh, he's on another whim, he's going to do this. Now he's doing poetry. Now he's become a tap dancer in the south of France with a mandolin player. There's a reason for it. What seems to happen with me is I struggle with the sculpture, drawings and stuff, and every sort of 5 or 6 years I need to make something which is a bit larger. Like, I built a primary school in 2007, you know, a real primary school that works.
A working primary school?
Yeah. Dalryan, Scotland. It's an experimental school which the Scottish Education Department funded. And it sort of works. But what's that got to do with sculpture? What's that got to do with anybody? It's got to do with part of the whole project. I come from Glasgow. I'm very influenced by McIntosh, who is a great architect. And he didn't just design the building. He designed the teaspoons and the door handles and everything, and the light switches. And he dealt with, you know. So that's the model.
Mm. And that's something that, again, I can relate that interest back to the film where you talk about the great Gesamtkunstwerk in the...
the great Gesamtkunstwerk, yeah. The man who read it out couldn't say, it took him 25 attempts to say Gesamtkunstwerk, yeah. No, I like the Gesamtkunstwerk is a very interesting idea, but it doesn't help you if you're a career-type artist. You have to have a brand and you have to have an object or a painting, and you promote that. Well, I'm not interested in that.
Is that not a relatively recent development, though?
What, the brand?
Yeah, the notion that an artist is a brand, has it?
It seems to be quite recent, yeah, but I mean, I don't know, Picasso, Rembrandt, I don't know, they all had a Mondrian. You can identify them, but you can't identify some other artists. You can't identify. I didn't realize Georges Van Tongeren designed an airport. When I saw it, I thought, and a bloody good airport it is too. Sculpture's the way forward. This is a moving sculpture stage, supported by Anda.
Any aspiring art students who might be listening should definitely go for a sculpture degree over anything else.
Absolutely, because I think you learn how to make stuff with stuff, and you learn how to understand things. And most conceptual art, or most conceptual artists, should I say, came out of the sculpture departments of the world. They were making stuff and then abandoned making stuff, but they weren't making paintings as such. Painting implies putting a paint on a surface. But I wasn't doing that. I was doing things with air, bits of carpet, whatever I could find, you know. So it's quite interesting. Sculpture is the way forward.
When we talk about this piece, which is going to be on display here at the Coronet, a film that will be for people to come and see, what else is going to be happening? There's going to be some performances taking place as well, right?
Well, we've got to project the thing just to see how it looks, and then we have to work out how we're going to make interventions within that. We're going to make some interventions, not continuously, but at certain points there'll be a kind of intervention using cardboard or stuff called triwall. It's very reinforced corrugated cardboard.
Is that kind of projection and the interventions, is that something that you've played with before?
Many times, yeah. That's not new as far as I'm concerned, but I quite like the idea that it's not just the audience sitting looking at one thing. Something might come out like that, and Gary and I will be on stage some of the time, responding to what and how we want, and every night hopefully it will be different. I mean, somebody's tipped me the nod, and I think we might be getting a BAFTA.
A what?
A BAFTA.
What's BAFTA?
Well, it's not a BAFTA. No. So, I mean, we could play with all this. I mean, basically, I have to say things like, you know, when the film is, I've said here, it's a foam board fiasco. It's a torch-lit trash. It's a Millibandian omni-shambles of unequal proportions. It's a corrugated cardboard confusion. I mean, if you say all that, then it becomes part of the work.
And this is... an incredibly exciting interdisciplinary set of offering that's coming up. How does it fit into your programming for the Coronet?
It fits very well because our program is very diverse,
yeah.
From theater to fine art to performing arts, drama, poetry, music, and so on. So I think this fits just right. Mm. I really do.
You were showing us around just before we sat down for this interview, and it's an incredible building. It's like labyrinthine. You've made various sort of architectural interventions here and there, changing the stage, or building the stage rather, and sort of subsuming the original first floor of seating.
Yes.
How does this kind of talk of sculpture and this idea of projection as sculpture and performance as part of sculpture, how does that feed into it? Because you clearly have a very keen sense of spatial design.
Yes.
Have you found that something that you've kind of picked up in Bruce's work that you sort of identify with a bit?
Well, to be honest, when I've seen some of the Bruce's work, I was very much drawn to it, especially the last show we did together.
Yeah.
I was fascinated with the... He probably did about 2,000 little sketches of what the set and the screen is going to look like. I don't really know how to explain it, but yes, I was very much drawn to that. It spoke to me.
And is that kind of space, when you're looking for somewhere to host these sorts of things, is this kind of space, does it stimulate you? Is it exciting? Yeah.
Well, the person who owns the space stimulates me, and she energizes the whole thing, and has got an attitude which permeates the whole thing, which I like. We've tried to put it on in other spaces, you know, and had a lot of problems with people being very kind of snotty in a kind of uninformed or ill-informed way about things. I mean, the thing is, I actually am a sculptor, as I said, but I'm interested in the notion of transient sculpture. I wanted to be a dancer, where my body and my actions are the work. Mm-hmm. And so the theatre is something which interests me. My father used to take me to the theatre all the time in Glasgow. I mean, I've seen a lot of things from Jack Benny to W.C. Fields on stage, you know, which is pretty fantastic. And you think, well, this is pretty good. And I like the notion of kind of Liberace and Barnett Newman in the same place. You know, I don't think there's any difference between Liberace. Well, there is a difference. Of course there's a difference, but I quite like the collision between Barnett Newman and Liberace. Or Johnny Ray. Jackson Pollock was the action painter. Johnny Ray was an action singer. You may not have heard of Johnny Ray, but I'm working on a musical with Johnny Ray at the moment with a friend of mine, a friend of mine, and we'll discuss
friend
it.
Friend of ours.
Friend of ours, yeah. and we're having a lot of difficulty getting it put together because nobody's ever heard of Johnny Ray, but Johnny Ray was bigger than Elvis and bigger than Bing Crosby.
Yeah.
That is high. Anyway, that's another story.
That is another story.
An action singer. The theatrics of the man were more interesting than the singing.
That kind of theatricality and that collision, it sounds like what in part you're kind of reacting to is the highbrow and the lowbrow colliding.
Yeah.
How have you kind of processed that in at least in this?
Well, I sort of managed to do it somehow with some of the painting. I made pages of potatoes and things that seem to be something people seem to be able to handle together in some sort of funny way, or a scone off a plate, or different things. No, I think it's quite... I mean, I've been in the best galleries in the world, and I've been in the best shows in the world all through my history of doing stuff. So, I mean, Ed Ruscha knows who I am, and I know Ed Ruscha. Well, we were talking about him earlier. Mm. So it's kind of like, you can do what you want. As long as you do what you feel is correct or right for you and true to yourself, you can get away with anything, really, in a sense.
Well, it seems like as long as you do it with a sense of humour as well.
Well, absolutely. But, I mean, although I may have a sense of humour, I'm actually pretty damn serious, actually. I'm pretty depressed most of the time, as Andy will tell you, sitting there glum in a room upstairs. No. I'm quite glum about things. And, but I think what amuses me is the seriousness of artists and the poor-facedness of it and the kind of solemnity of it all. I mean, it's only stuff. It's not flesh and blood.
Mm.
But you have to retain a sense of humour about yourself and about what you're doing. Very important.
Well, I think you do. And I also think that, you know, a sense of humour in art is something people seem to be picking up a bit more on it now. There was a big exhibition at the South London Gallery fairly recently about humour in art.
Did you see that?
It was quite funny. I mean, bits of it were interesting.
I was in a show in Zurich called A Certain Smile. It was meant to be a show of funny artists. And it was probably the most unfunny experience I had. All the other artists I found quite tedious, really, actually. Mm-hmm. Except Sigmar Polka, he was funny. But everyone else seemed a bit full-faced about it all, I thought. It didn't seem to work very well.
Serious about being funny.
Yeah, but it's kind of like if you try to do something about it, it kind of stuffs it, you know. I mean, I was talking earlier on about George Klusberg from South America, from Iran, I think, called from... CAYC, Centre de Arte and Comunicación. And he used to bore everybody rigid with sending these bloody magazines out every month. He would just chuck them in the bin. But he was so upset with me being funny in Venice that he locked me out of the Palazzo Grazzi on the pontoon with some other artists because we were laughing so much. And it was a performance festival, so we had a Tavola Rotonda to discuss what happened, and I actually made a round table, but that didn't fit into the room, and he didn't like that. Couldn't get it through the door, so we had to saw it up to get it. I mean, it didn't get it, you know. And because live art can be live. You can make it up as you go along. Anything you can make it. And that's the beauty of being in this place. We can invent things tomorrow when we get onto the stage with the projected images, we can think, oh, that might be quite good to put a mirror there. Oh, let's put a standard lamp there. Let's get Andy to stand there. Let's do this. We haven't quite got to that point yet, but that's we feel, Gary and I feel, very able to be able to do that here. Mm. And that's a great luxury in this day and age.
Bruce MacLean there with Corona Theatres and the Winter, speaking to Augustine Macellari. And Gary Chitty and Bruce MacLean's film installation, The Decorative Potential of Blazing Factories, is on show at the Corona Theatre from the 19th to the 22nd of June. You are with the Monaco Weekly.
That, Fernando, is it for edition 519 of the Monaco Weekly.
You made it for a happier day after all the rain, right, Rob?
Yeah, it was good stuff. It was lovely to share the studio with you. Shall we thank our pals behind the glass? Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Cassie Galpin. The Monaco Weekly will be back same time, same place next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Fernando Guttapascheco.
Thanks for tuning in.